Welcome to the latest edition of the RVC podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. Today I'm talking with Dr. Oliver Garden of the RVC's Department of Veterinary Clinical Studies about his interest in immune-mediated diseases and specifically the role of the regulatory T-cell in this, in both dogs and in other species. Hello, Oliver, and thanks very much for joining us today. Can you start off by telling us, please, what autoimmune diseases are?
Yes, certainly. Well, first of all, maybe I should set the scene by saying that immune-mediated disease in general is a really important area of veterinary medicine, and it does account, certainly in my own area, dogs and cats, for a large number of admissions to private and referral veterinary practices. But autoimmune diseases are that subset of general immune-mediated disease that involves an attack of the immune system towards normal body tissues. So it's essentially the body's immune system attacking normal tissues in an inappropriate way and therefore causing damage or loss of function or inappropriate inflammation. And it can be both guided or directed at specific tissues, and a good example of that would be myasthenia gravis, for example, or it can be more anatomically dispersed and attack multiple tissues throughout the body, and these are called polysystemic immune-mediated diseases. And the most common or stereotypical example of that would be lupus, systemic lupus erythematosus, both of people and of veterinary patients, in particular dogs.
Okay, so which of these diseases are you most interested in?
So we've done work in the context of various diseases in the past. We have published in the area of lupus. We have looked at that from an animal model point of view, and that has relevance both to the veterinary species that we treat, dogs and cats in my case, but also human medicine as well. We've also done work on type 1 diabetes mellitus, sugar diabetes, if you will, and a model of inflammatory bowel disease, in particular colitis, and all of those are solid models for both the human and potentially veterinary diseases, naturally occurring veterinary diseases. But in general, in terms of a clinical perspective, I have a broad interest in most immune-mediated diseases that we see in the clinics, and these might include, for example, immune-mediated hemolytic anemia, immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, or immune-mediated polyarthritis. So all of those are certainly of interest to me from a clinical perspective. From the research perspective, we focus down on some particular diseases that have certain characteristics that have engaged me in the past.
Certainly, I mean, these are diseases which are reasonably common in veterinary practice and obviously cause a lot of problems for humans as well. So how do these diseases actually arise? Why do body cells start to attack themselves?
That's a very good question, and the answer to that often isn't known in particular, but the types of mechanisms that come into play are those that involve both cells of the so-called innate immune system. These are parts of the immune system that come into play immediately, and they may include cells such as neutrophils and mast cells. And then you have other aspects of the immune system like T and B cells. These are components of the adaptive immune system, and they have perhaps a later role, but a very important one in numerous immune-mediated diseases. And the question as to why these cells and molecules suddenly start to behave in an unregulated, damaging way is a very good one. There are numerous trigger factors that are thought to play a role in the onset of these diseases, including, for example, nonspecific inflammation that may kill cells and release normally hidden or sequestered proteins that may then be the subject of an immune-mediated attack. An example of this is the beta cell, the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas that then leads to diabetes mellitus. There are numerous mechanisms in place to try to avoid autoimmune processes from occurring in the first place. These are both at the level of the development of the cells, in which a lot of the potentially autoaggressive cells are removed in the first place, but that isn't a perfect mechanism, and there are also then mechanisms in the periphery that remove those rogue, if you will, escaping potentially autoaggressive cells. And if those peripheral mechanisms fail, either because of a loss of function or a number of those particular cells that mediate that function, then again, you may see in the right genetic environment an autoimmune attack. Other mechanisms that are thought to play a role would include molecular mimicry, namely the mimicry of autoantigens, tissue proteins, put in a more simple way. by, for example, infectious agents that may have a similar molecular structure in three dimensions that then trigger an immune-mediated response that then cross-reacts with the normal body tissues. And there are some good examples of diseases in which that may play a role too. And then the final trigger factor for autoimmune disease would be alteration of self-proteins, for example, by mutations, by modifications because of chemical reactions and so on, that again may lead to inappropriate immune responses in tissues that would not normally be subject to them. And again, there are some examples of those in both human and indeed in veterinary medicine. And that latter category would include hypersensitivity responses such as, for example, idiosyncratic drug reactions. And an example that I can think of immediately would be sulfonamide hypersensitivity, typically in Doberman Pinscher dogs, and we all know about these and the need to test ocular tear production, for example, prior to using those drugs because of the possibility of an inappropriate immune response because those drugs attach themselves to normal proteins and alter the normal proteins in such a way that they then become the subject of an immune-mediated attack that then destroys the tissues, which could include ocular tissues and so on.
Okay, so what are the normal mechanisms then that exist in the body to stop these autoimmune attacks happening?
Okay, there are numerous mechanisms, and they would be both the central mechanisms. As I say, when these cells are developing in the course of their normal development, those cells that have inappropriate reactivity to self, either B cells developing in the bone marrow or T cells developing in the thymus, they would be eliminated by a process called deletion, by apoptosis, cell death, if you will. But, and this leads to wholesale purging of the developing repertoire of those potentially autoaggressive clones. Over 90, 95% of thymocytes are killed in that way because they're potentially autoaggressive. Not quite such a large number of developing B cells, but certainly over 50%. However, that isn't perfect, and in fact, potentially for good biological reasons, not all of those autoaggressive cells are eliminated. And so you also need peripheral mechanisms in place, and these would include mechanisms such as, for example, ignorance. So some tissues, proteins are never exposed to the immune system in health, so they're sequestered either anatomically or by various immune mechanisms in place. You may also have deletion in the periphery, whereby if a potentially autoaggressive cell recognizes the antigen to which it has cognate specificity, it may be that that reaction leads to a death signal to the actual clone itself, thereby purging it from the peripheral repertoire in a similar way to the way in which they're purged from the central tissues and organs. Other mechanisms in place include phenotypic skewing, in which a particular type of, in this case I'm thinking about T cells, may alter their phenotype, their characteristics to become non-pathogenic, again switching from Th1 to Th2 or sometimes the other way. And then finally you do have mechanisms that are thought to be more extrinsic, so involving third-party cells that may have a tolerance-inducing role, and these would be including antigen-presenting cells that interact with T cells, in particular dendritic cells, that may lead to the generation of less immunogenic or indeed tolerogenic cells. And the best example of a tolerogenic cell would be the regulatory T cell, whose function it is to try and damp down or abrogate these inappropriate immune responses mediated by a whole plethora of cells potentially. So all of these mechanisms are interacting, and this is a really complicated area, and regulatory T cells alone, which is my own area of interest, encompasses a whole plethora of different cell types all interacting in a rather complicated fashion that we certainly don't understand fully yet.
Yes, it sounds like a very long-term labour then to try and unpick all of that. So what then is the role of the regulatory T cell in these immune responses? That's your main area of interest, isn't it?
It is, and they, as I say, have a predominant role to try and damp down inappropriate immune responses to both extrinsic proteins, antigens, if you will, and these might include gut bacteria or indeed some pathogens, but also in a different sense they have a big role to play in preventing the development of autoaggressive responses. And if I can just concentrate on that second role, they do this in a variety of ways, but essentially they are thought to be the main mechanism for preventing those escaping auto-aggressive or auto-specific thymocytes, now T cells in the periphery, from wreaking havoc. So immune regulation is a large part of their function, and they have interactions with both cells of the innate immune system, and these would include, for example, neutrophils, mast cells, monocytes, macrophages. They even interact with cells that you don't classically associate with the immune system, for example, osteoclasts as well. But they also interact very importantly with cells of the adaptive immune system, namely T and B cells, again to try and prevent these autoaggressive mechanisms. They also have a role in so-called immune homeostasis, which is all about keeping the pool of peripheral CD4 helper and CD8 cytotoxic T cells at the right number. One can imagine without these mechanisms in place, you'd have an overabundant population of cells literally crowding out immune organs and also other tissues. And so they play a role. Other mechanisms play a role as well, but regulatory T cells play a role in controlling the size of the peripheral pool of naive CD4, that's T helper cells, and memory CD8, that's cytotoxic T cells. And if I can draw out a few particular examples, they have a very important role in the gut in preventing over-exuberant immune-mediated attack on gut tissue. Right. And in this particular role, a particular molecule is thought to be important in getting them to the gut, the alpha E beta 7 integrin. And then also in the role of the gut mucosal defenses, that would include the gut, but also the nasal tissues and maybe even the urinary tract too, they have a role in helping the B cells produce IgA, which is a very important antibody in the control of mucosal defenses. So they have a role both in immune regulation and in the defense of mucosal barriers and in the immune homeostasis, namely keeping peripheral T cell numbers at the correct level. And as I say, they have a role in trying to defervesce a developing immune response to an external antigen, such as to a pathogen. If that continues unabated, then again you can get secondary inflammatory events, and it's thought that the adaptive regulatory T cells may play more of a role in trying to contain those anti-pathogenic immune responses so that when they have served their role, they then don't go on to create inappropriate inflammation.
Okay, so I guess one way you may try and tackle an autoimmune disease, an over-exuberant immune response, if you like, is through upregulating the function of T cells, regulatory T cells, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how are you studying the role of these cells?
Okay, we have used a variety of approaches in the past, and basically they involve both basic biology, namely in vitro, in glass, if you will, experiments in the lab, but also some in vivo experiments where we've looked, for example, at clinical patients, and with the Clinical Investigation Center, we've taken residual samples from diagnostic specimens to try and get a handle on the way in which diseases develop. But coming back to the in vitro work, we have developed a number of culture assays to look at the behavior of these regulatory T cells interacting with conventional, that is, non-regulatory T cells, and we have a number of readouts, and we've used that particular assay system as a platform for understanding the way in which regulatory T cell function goes wrong in mouse models of lupus, for example, and also mouse models of inflammatory bowel disease. And it's been a very versatile, robust assay system that we've been able to leverage in both of those contexts. Mm-hmm. However, all of this work ultimately needs in vivo work to continue it, to verify conclusions you develop in vitro. We've done some of that too. We have a number of techniques in the lab that we're using at the moment, including predominantly flow cytometry, which is a method of characterizing the cells, the markers on their surface, by means of antigens coupled to fluorochromes that fluoresce a particular color when a laser is shone on them. And thereby you can distinguish particular markers on these cells and characterize their phenotype in a very elegant manner. We've also done molecular biological studies with the technique of quantitative PCR, again to look at the characteristics of regulatory T cells, and we've used this most particularly more recently in our work in the dog, in which we've characterized for the first time the function and detailed phenotype of regulatory T cells. Other methods that we've used in the past have included ELISAs and Western blotting, and we've also done some work with colleagues at South Kensington at the Imperial College London campus looking at the glycobiology of these cells, namely the sugar interactions and the sugar patterns on their surface, both by means of a mass spectrometry-based approach and also a transcriptomic-type approach, where we look at the mRNA transcripts in a chip-based assay. From the clinical perspective, I am a clinician myself, and I do have a role to play in the Queen Mother Hospital alongside colleagues, and we try to do informed, ethically rigorous research looking at the phenotype of outbred normal natural diseases in dogs and hopefully in the future in cats as well, in which we're able to get a handle on how these diseases play out in our veterinary patients.
So what is it that makes a T-reg cell different from other lymphocytes or other immune cells generally?
That's a good question, and it's one that's developing, it's evolving, and I think one can answer that in two ways. First of all, the phenotype, namely the basic characteristics from a cellular identification point of view of regulatory cells, often is very different from that of conventional, that is, non-regulatory cells. And you can look, for example, at the most commonly, I would say, investigated regulatory cell, the naturally occurring regulatory cell, which has a particular phenotype. Again, without going into too much detail, but for the immunologists who may be interested, these regulatory cells express high levels of CD44, low levels of CD45RB, either high or low of the L-selectin, CD62 ligand, and they express other more unique markers such as the folate receptor 4 and the IL-7 receptor alpha chain. They express a low level of that, so they're CD127 low. And other markers have been characterized over the years, but no one marker is ideal in that there is always a situation in conventional cells for the vast majority of these markers in which they also adopt the phenotype of a regulatory cell under certain circumstances. Mm. So, for example, we typically isolate ex vivo in mice these cells by means of their high constitutive expression of CD25, the IL-2 receptor alpha chain, but unfortunately conventional non-regulatory cells also upregulate this chain upon activation, albeit transiently. When the activation stimulus is removed, their expression of CD25 diminishes, whereas that of the regulators is constitutive. They are also anergic in vitro. Let me explain that term. So anergy relates to a lack of normal proliferation, for example. If you're using proliferation, which is the most common readout for these types of assays, they lack the normal proliferative response in the absence of exogenous IL-2 to normally immunogenic stimuli, for example, beads coated with anti-CD3 and CD28 antibodies. So they show that in vitro characteristic. But the most important way of distinguishing them from conventional, that is, non-regulatory cells, is in their function. So they have a very robustly demonstrable suppressive function in vitro, and we've shown this in our assay system, looking at readouts that have included proliferation measured by tritiated thymidine incorporation, by the dilution of dyes that are incorporated in the cytoplasm. As each daughter wave of progeny develops, so the dye concentration diminishes by 50%, and so you can identify different waves of proliferation. And again, these cells will suppress the normal proliferation in vitro of conventional non-regulatory cells, and so you're able to demonstrate that they have that regulatory function. We've also demonstrated regulation of cytokines, so they will damp down the ability of conventional cells to elaborate cytokines such as IL-2, interferon gamma, and TNF-alpha. And once again, they show all these different characteristics that enable you to identify them from a functional as well as from a phenotypic point of view. Perhaps the best phenotypic marker that we know to date, at least in mouse, also in human but not quite so watertight, is the transcriptional molecule called FOXP3. It's a member of the forkhead box protein family. And FOXP3 is the best way we have of identifying these cells, both in mouse and in man. Unfortunately, in human beings, FOXP3 is also upregulated, again transiently, in conventional cells that are exposed to a stimulus, but not so in mouse. You can't make mouse conventional cells express FOXP3. So in that species, at least, it's a very watertight marker of regulatory T cells.
So do these markers actually have a role in the molecular mechanism of action of the T-reg? How does this actually then work in practice?
Yes, they absolutely do. And again, the number of mechanisms of action of these cells are large. There's a myriad of potential mechanisms in which they may suppress cells of both the innate and the adaptive immune system. If we come to FOXP3, first of all, that all-important transcriptional, both activator and repressor, depending upon the target gene, that originally was thought to be a master regulator or master factor, if you will, for Treg ontogeny and function. More recently, that view has been modified. It's still thought to be very important in the phenotypic integrity of these cells, but not necessarily a master gene, if you will, but nevertheless very important. A number of the molecules that we've mentioned in this conversation are important in function. So, for example, CD25, the IL-2 receptor alpha chain, is thought to confer upon these cells an ability to consume large quantities of IL-2, and by consuming large quantities of IL-2, they deprive conventional cells of that essential growth factor, and those conventional cells in turn will undergo intrinsic mediated apoptosis. This is one of several mechanisms of action of these cells. In vitro, at least, they have a very important contact dependency, so they will need contact with the conventional cells in order to mediate their suppressive function. In other words, it will not occur usually across a transwell. If we're talking about naturally occurring regulatory T cells, the CD4, CD25 expressors, if you will. And what molecules are involved in that contact-dependent mechanism is largely controversial, but molecules that have been incriminated have included CTLA-4, CD152, expressed by, and again in a constitutive manner, by the regulatory T cells. LAG-3 is another molecule that's thought to play a role in activated murine regulatory T cells, for example. Cytokines are thought to play a role, but not necessarily in vitro, potentially more in vivo. Whether this is because the regulators themselves are releasing the cytokines or inducing other cells to release cytokines in a secondary fashion isn't really very clear, but in vivo, cytokines such as IL-10 and TGF-beta appear to have more of a role. In mouse in particular, in the last few years, IL-35 is also thought to play a role as an immunosuppressive cytokine in mouse, not so far in man. Other mechanisms may include the catabolism of adenosine phosphates in the microenvironment of the Tregs, and this leads ultimately to the production of adenosine by CD73 and CD39 acting in a concerted fashion, and adenosine has an immunosuppressive role on conventional cells. So again, that's yet another mechanism that they're thought to play a role. They do kill conventional cells, as I mentioned, by a number of mechanisms, one of which is the deprivation of IL-2. Other mechanisms would include Fas-Fas ligand. They're thought to kill B cells, for example, in this way. They mediate death by the release of galectins 1, 3, and 10. Other people have described perforin granzyme mechanisms of action. The list is endless. It goes on, and it's very difficult to know if these cells all have the ability to unleash all of these mechanisms, or if they have specialized subsets, or indeed if there's a hierarchical context-dependent mechanism of action. In other words, there's a core mechanism, such as CTLA-4 has been described, and then other mechanisms are brought into play, either depending upon the microenvironment, for example, IL-10 in vivo may be important in the intestine, and or in context to the degree of suppression required. So potentially they can unleash the mechanisms in an incremental fashion to try and subdue a particularly exuberant immune response, for example.
How is the function, or is the function of Tregs impaired to permit autoimmunity? Is this something that is a particular factor in that?
Yes, certainly a number of autoimmune diseases have been examined in this context, not just autoimmune diseases, I would say. So people have also looked at asthma, more allergic type diseases, but also cancer too. They play a role in cancer as well. It's sort of controversial, I have to say, but they certainly play a role in that group of diseases too. So for autoimmune diseases, there are a number of hypothetical defects that you can envision in regulatory T cell function, and these might include, for example, defects in their thymic selection, so there may be gaps or holes in the repertoire. In other words, they may not have the ability to detect certain autoantigens and thereby mediate suppression against inappropriate attack directed towards those autoantigens by conventional cells. So there may be holes in the repertoire for various reasons. We've looked at some of these ourselves. There may be loss or defective expression of some of their surface markers. So you might imagine a situation in which they have low surface expression of CD25, the IL-2 receptor alpha chain, which is thought to feed several important signals by virtue of IL-2, both for their ontogeny and also their peripheral survival and competitive fitness, if you will. Again, if the expression of that marker for some reason were to go down, one would imagine a situation in which they may not be as fit as they would otherwise be. There could be defective stimulation of regulatory T cells by antigen-presenting cells that may have inappropriate activity, for example, a lack of co-stimulation. It's known that CD28 signals are important in T-reg ontogeny and to an extent function too. There may be defective conversion of cells into regulators, so there are various mechanisms. I haven't touched on these yet, but we're not only talking about naturally occurring T-regs here, namely those that are released from the thymus as a regulatory cell, but we're also talking about cells that in the periphery start off their life as conventional cells and then for various reasons, for example, if they've been activated in the context of IL-10 or TGF-beta, both immunosuppressive cytokines, they then in turn can become regulatory cells, and it's conceivable that that mechanism of conversion could be defective in certain autoimmune diseases, for example. And finally, and as we described in lupus, in the mouse model of lupus, and that's subsequently been demonstrated in the human disease as well, much to our delight, is the fact that the conventional cells may have mechanisms in place in which they resist the activity of otherwise normal regulators. So they may be resistant or defective in their receipt of regulatory signals. So are there examples of autoimmune diseases in which these mechanisms have played a role? Well, yes, again, it's an evolving field. It's somewhat controversial, but there are a number of diseases which we can look at that have had defects ascribed to regulatory T cell number or function. So, for example, in human, autoimmune lymphoproliferative syndrome is characterized by a marked reduction in the number of Tregs in the peripheral blood. People have looked at diseases such as multiple sclerosis, again, defective numbers and or function, but again, different studies show different conclusions. Unfortunately, the area is a little bit mired by disparate results from one group to another or one context and another. People have looked at ulcerative colitis and again have shown a reduced number in the blood, potentially either no or some defect in the function. Other diseases that you might expect would be associated with a reduced number of function of regulators, in fact, it's the opposite, paradoxically. So rheumatoid arthritis, there's either been increased frequencies or no change in the blood populations of regulatory T cells, and indeed in synovial fluid, there is a larger number with greater function of regulatory T cells. So again, this may then be an epiphenomenon rather than the primary pathogenic mechanism. In other words, the body's trying to overcome another mechanism in place that has led to that disease rather than the defect in Tregs being a primary entity in that disease. Again, in my own area of interest, type 1 diabetes, certainly people have demonstrated reduced numbers or no change in blood, depending upon the study. And again, people have documented reduced function or no change in function in certain models and human patients. And finally, lupus, again, very controversial because it's a very heterogeneous disease, often difficult to diagnose initially. And one factor that comes into play when considering numbers and or function of regulatory cells, both in blood and tissues, if you can have access to the tissues, is the activity of the disease. So again, this plays a role in lupus, where you may have relatively quiescent disease, or you may have very active disease, and the conclusions as to numbers and function of regulatory cells may well vary according to the activity of the disease in question, which is a really important point in comparing one study to the next.
So what's known so far, or what have you found with regard to our domestic animal species?
Right, okay. Well, let me set the scene. Not much is known, actually. It's a very evolving field, and which is why we have an interest and we hope to make a contribution. I think the most widely documented species in which regulatory function has been characterized to date is the cat, and people from the very well-acclaimed North Carolina State University group have done some really great work looking at feline T-Rex. And for example, this group has both characterized them from a basic immunology point of view, but also shown that FIV, for example, preferentially replicates in activated CD4, CD25 positive T-Rex. And this is independent of cellular proliferation and correlates with the surface expression of the chemokine receptor CXCR4. Very elegant work ongoing with the feline then. Moving to my own immediate species, the dog, this has been an area of interest of mine for the last few years and indeed other groups throughout the world. So exploratory studies performed by Barbara Biller and others from Colorado State showed, first of all, phenotypically characterized along with us canine regulatory T cells based upon CD4 and FOXP3 expression. But also Barbara showed that there was an increased number and proportion of Tregs in the dog in the peripheral circulation and draining lymph nodes of dogs with various types of cancer. So she looked at oral melanoma, osteosarcoma, mast cell tumor, and others. And this work has been carried on by the same group in the publication by O'Neill and others 2 years ago, in which they also showed an increased proportion of Tregs in the blood of patients with carcinoma and an increased ratio of Tregs to CD8 positive T cells in T cell lymphoma, for example. But they also examined other types of cancer in which there were no changes in Treg numbers. So it presumably does vary according to the type of cancer and where you're looking. Horiuchi and others a year ago demonstrated increased proportions of Tregs in the blood of metastatic versus non-metastatic disease, suggesting that Tregs may play a role in metastasis. Again, early days yet, so this is an ongoing field. And more recently, Rosetto and others, this year in fact, documented no change in either the proportion of Tregs in either the peripheral blood or lymph nodes of control dogs versus those with osteosarcoma. So again, it does depend upon the model and disease you're looking at. So all of those preceding studies were in the context of cancer, which is obviously a very important group of diseases. But Keppel and others in 2008 also documented the increase in regulatory cells characterized by the expression of CD4 and FOXP3 in atopic dermatitis dogs undergoing allergen-specific immunotherapy. So while these are early days, regulatory T cells in the dog have been examined in the context of a number of cancers, and also in the context of allergic disease. So what has been our own contribution? Well, that has been in the detailed phenotypic and functional characterization of these cells in the dog. And we've done this largely through in vitro studies. We're now beginning to extend our in vitro work in the context of clinical patients, both with sepsis, bronchopneumonia, often secondary to aspiration of gastrointestinal contents, but also we hope in the near future to be extending these studies in the context of cancer ourselves, in particular lymphoma. So we have an interest in this area.
So in broad terms then, the characteristics of the Tregs that you found in dogs are pretty similar to those you've seen in other species?
Yes, surprisingly so. I mean, well, I say surprising. In many ways it was very rewarding to find this, because up until recently we were working on the basis of what we presumed were cross-reactive antibodies. So we started off labeling these cells with an anti-mouse rat FOXP3 antibody, and in due course with an anti-human CD25 antibody, which we and others have proven that they do what we think they do, namely associate with the relevant canine antigens. So with that in mind, we've been able to say with more confidence what the populations of cells are that we are examining, both functionally and also phenotypically.
So how do you see this story evolving to improve patient care, or indeed to prevent these sorts of autoimmune diseases arising in the future?
This is a really evolving field, and it's a very important one, because immunotherapy is probably the next big development step change in medicine, and indeed it is already happening now, both with largely antibody-mediated therapies, but also in due course, and clinical trials are ongoing, with cellular therapies of various descriptions. And one can imagine that the field would be divided into strategies required to control autoimmune disease versus those that would be required maybe to control cancer, because again, the objective, the ultimate goal in each of those contexts may be different. So looking at the context of autoimmune disease, one would imagine that you would wish to augment both perhaps the number and also the function of regulatory T cells, because again, in many diseases, one would speculate, and indeed it's been proven for some, that there are defects in regulatory T cell function that lead to the manifestation of the autoaggressive responses that are the basis of the disease in question. And increasing number or function of Tregs may be achieved, one can imagine, in various ways, one of which may be immunomodulatory therapy to augment Treg activities, and that could be along two particular pathways. First of all, pathway one would be to target the Tregs in vivo, and this could be by means of drug effects, for example, and this is already in the context of clinical trials in type 1 diabetes in humans. For example, humanized monoclonal antibodies against CD3 epsilon, the CD3 epsilon chain of the TCR complex. And again, it's thought that in some way recalibrates the balance between conventional and regulatory T cells, and indeed has been shown to halt progression over a rather long period, surprisingly long period, following the administration of the humanized antibody of the type 1 diabetes, leading to a preservation of the endogenous beta cell mass. Other antibody therapies that again may recalibrate the balance between the autoaggressive and the regulatory cells may be anti-CD20, for example, and this gets us into the realm of speculating, theorizing about the role of regulatory B cells. Other antibodies may be anti-CD52 and anti-CD45-RORA, all of which may have a selective ability to promote the activity or numbers of regulatory T cells while potentially depleting the number and or function of conventional autoaggressive cells. However, we need to be careful here in all of these approaches with antibodies, as we all vividly remember the anti-CD28 superagonist fiasco, the phase 1 safety study that proved disastrous a few years ago, in which rather than activating the function of regulatory T cells, as was proven in the mouse and in vitro, it had the effect, in fact, unfortunately, of alternatively activating and triggering the function of previously activated T cells and memory T cells, and so induced, rather than regulation, induced systemic inflammatory response syndrome, and we all know the consequences of that. Luckily, there were no fatalities, but certainly it was a close-run thing. Other strategies in which drugs may be useful, not only antibody therapies, but also now mainstream drugs, some of which are already in use, would be drugs that facilitate or augment the function or activity of Tregs with the benefit of suppressing the conventional cells. So, for example, rapamycin, which is a drug that is used in human medicine now, in vitro, at least, that directly promotes the expansion and the survival of regulatory T cells. So again, one could imagine in vivo that would have the influence of augmenting Treg function while suppressing conventional T cells. Mm-hmm. One could also imagine antigen-presenting cell therapies, for example, the infusion of tolerogenic dendritic cells. The second pathway, along the lines of immunomodulatory therapy that may be useful, would be actually expanding Tregs in vitro for the purposes of immunotherapy. So the first strategy, if you will, would be to augment their function in vivo, but the second strategy would be to try and increase numbers in vitro with a view of then adoptively transferring them back to the patient at a subsequent date by virtue of trying to suppress an autoimmune disease, for example. And different strategies have been explored for the purposes of in vitro expansion of Tregs, for example, artificial antigen-presenting cells, namely expressing Fc receptors that are then used to attach antibodies such as anti-CD3 and CD28. People have used antigen-pulsed dendritic cells, We in the lab have also used anti-CD3, CD28 coated beads in the context of very high concentrations of IL-2 to expand Tregs in vitro, and people have also used MHC peptide and anti-CD28 coated beads as well, all with a view of expanding the numbers of Tregs as a prelude then to using them in immunotherapeutic approaches. There are a number of problems and challenges here. This is not just a simplistic case of putting cells back in that are deficient. One has to be very aware of some of the caveats here, which include deriving them in sufficient number, either in vivo or expanding them in vitro and then putting them back into the patient. So expanding these cells is always challenging. Of course, there are GMP constraints. Clearly, infection and so on would be of paramount importance not to leave the patient vulnerable to infection, iatrogenic, for example. Antigen specificity is always a factor to consider. People have explored, and we indeed ourselves have explored, the possibility of genetically engineering regulatory T cells, in other words, giving them a particular specificity, which would hopefully then direct them to the tissue undergoing autoimmune attack. So we've put T cell receptors expressing or with a specificity for islet antigens into conventional cells with a FOXP3 construct and shown that they do have regulatory function in vitro. Again, there are some potential risks here, and we have to be very cautious and very rigorous in our evaluation of these strategies, of course, before they are ever put into patients. Another risk of putting in Tregs would be the risk of phenotypic conversion, so the stability of Tregs would also need to be considered. Their lability in the context of inflammation has been documented, so you could imagine a situation in which you'd infuse Tregs and the inflammation in the patient may be so severe as to convert those Tregs into now auto-specific, conventional, auto-aggressive cells if their phenotypic characteristics are not locked in. And indeed, reversion to a pro-inflammatory phenotype has been shown in various contexts. Mm. And last but not least, putting in loads of Tregs, you might imagine, too, would risk global immunosuppression, which is another consideration in all of these cellular immunotherapies. Now, in cancer, the situation is a bit different, and although it's somewhat controversial, most people conceive the Treg as playing a deleterious role in cancer in crippling the normal antineoplastic immune responses. This is controversial. Some people would regard Tregs in certain contexts to be beneficial. In particular for hemolymphatic types of cancer, it's really controversial as to whether they're playing a good role or a bad role. That's still a very evolving field, one in which we have an interest ourselves. But on the whole, most people would regard Tregs as being of negative influence in the context of solid tissue cancer. And so the idea here would be to try and deplete them alongside giving tumour vaccines, for example, to boost the normal antineoplastic immune responses. And already some strategies are in place. So people have explored the immunotoxin Denileukin diftatox, which is a fusion between IL-2 and the diphtheria toxin, the idea being to try and target the toxin to the Tregs, the naturally occurring subset of which express high levels of the IL-2 receptor alpha chain, in a constitutive manner, as I mentioned earlier on. So this may be a way of killing those cells, and people have tried this in human patients with some success, depending upon the type of cancer. Other strategies that are being explored would include inhibition of tumour-specific Treg expansion and or functional inactivation. And I would say that already now, although many of these strategies may be portrayed as at the moment as science fiction, certainly some of the anti-cancer drugs that we currently give, such as cyclophosphamide, especially in a metronomic setting, may exert their influence by selectively depleting Tregs. And so again, altering the balance, in this case, towards that of the antineoplastic conventional effector cells that hopefully will therefore have a better chance of fighting the cancer with the removal of the crippling influence of the regulatory T cells.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, it sounds like obviously it's a rather complicated field, but I look forward to hearing about the progress ongoing with this, and one day hopefully we'll be treating type 1 diabetes in dogs a bit more effectively. So thank you very much, Oliver.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you very much for listening once again. I hope very much you'll be able to listen to us again next time. In the meantime, if you have any comments or suggestions with regard to the podcast, as ever, you're free to email us at podcast@rvc.ac.uk. Goodbye.